you know, didn't happen to hear how this was all set up, maybe just a quick explanation in that regard. The appointed representatives and the powers that be, i.e. the saints, decided to, you know, to give me a couple of different options. And one of the options that they gave me was a series of four meetings, and the topics were historical points in Adventist history. So that's the one I opted for. So we have 1844 tonight. Tomorrow morning we have 1888, and then 1901. That must be in the afternoon, I guess, and then an evening meeting that would be 2016, which is more or less now. And the idea is to kind of relate the three previous episodes to where we are today, and you know, if there's any significance to that. You know, it's always a little tricky when people specify a topic. it's easier if they specify a topic you know something about, and it's less easy if they specify a topic that you know nothing about. But it's a good thing. And actually, this is the fourth time where people have specifically specified a given topic, and this was less than the others. I'll have to say that much. In this regard, it was less than the others. Because the other three occasions that I'm thinking of, they said, Dave, we want you to talk about. And it was one of those, it's sure a good thing we're on the phone here because I'm rolling my eyes and I wouldn't want him to see that. and this was not that bad. And this was by email anyhow, so that was even extra safe. But, but you know, so I wondered about it. I thought, you know, okay, so what am I going to do with those exact things, you know? And there's just, you know, we could just do a kind of a historical coverage. But to be honest, any one of those things could easily take up, you know, 2 weeks of class time, you know, in a regular class. Because these are big topics. So, you know, first thing you're going to realize is we're never going to cover everything that might be said on any of these topics. So I'm thinking about that, and I'm saying, okay, so if you can't get everything, what do you throw out? You know. And anyhow, a couple of mornings ago, as I was, I'd woken up, and I was lying in bed, and I was just thinking, and all of a sudden, I just saw a common thread through all of these, and so that's what we're going to go chasing, is the common thread. The downside is that there's a lot of the historical factoid type stuff that we won't be able to cover. Okay, we'll try to cover enough so that you kind of know what was going on at least. But I want to look at the thread, because the thread, I'm convinced, is the important thing, and that's the one that will extend down to 2016 rather than all the little ins and the outs and the details. So anyhow, that's what we're talking about here. Let's see. I'm going to argue in a polite way, a gentleman's argument type of thing, that this common thread that we're going to be looking at is actually the common defining thread of God's work basically at all times and in all places. Okay, it's the very heart and soul of the great controversy, so to speak, and you know, as such, I nominate it for being important. I think that you could make a case that direction. It's kind of like an airplane in a certain sense. The pilot always knows where he wants to end up, but he's not always flying towards the eventual target. I heard a figure, which I don't know, kind of doubt, but yeah, you get these figures that get reported in the popular meme type of thing, you know, urban legend. You know, the idea was that on the average airline flight, the plane is actually only pointed at the landing point something, I don't remember what it was, something like less than 3% of the time. I don't really know if that's, you know, I mean, how many degrees off do you go before you don't count it pointing? But anyhow, The fact is that, yeah, if you're wanting to fly due east, but maybe there's a thunderstorm in the way, you know, so you're going to have to go around it somehow or the other. And so this thread that we'll be following, and I, just by way of illustration sake, I refer to it as a fuse. You know, has anybody ever used one of those? I never have, I'll just be honest. So I don't, all I know about them is mostly what I've seen on cartoons when I was a kid, to be honest. But you know, you got this long thing that looks like a string, and you light one end and it goes, you know, and eventually the bomb blows up or something happens at the other end. But a fuse is I like the imagery of it because it's moving on. Yeah, they're waterproof. You know, it can burn underwater. I don't really know how they do that, but they do that, you know. It can burn underwater, and it's moving on. And I think that's the way God is. You know, this thing's moving on. Sometimes it's wound into curlicues, maybe, and sometimes maybe it does go underwater, and sometimes it's buried in the dirt, and you can't see it, but it's moving on anyhow. So anyhow, that's kind of the imagery that I have out of this. So that's why I subtitled here "Lighting the Fuse." Okay. Okay. Let's see. Let's go on. What else do we have here? I think I hit the wrong button. Let's try that one. Okay. That's good by way of introduction. Okay. Now a different introduction. Got to introduce a different aspect, and that is the concept of studying history at all. And I think this supports where we're going, so I wanted to just take a moment and spend a little time with some philosophy of what history should be all about. Because history is often, it often misses the mark, in my opinion. So let's try this statement for size here. In the annals of human history, the growth of nations, the rise and fall of empires, appear as dependent on the will and prowess of man. The shaping of events seems to a great degree to be determined by his power, ambition, or caprice. But in the Word of God, the curtain is drawn aside, and we behold behind, above, and through all the play and counterplay of human interests and power and passions, the agencies of the All-Merciful One silently, patiently working out the counsels of His own will. I like to think that would include the current election cycle, though this one is maybe a little harder to see clearly than some others in the past. But silently, patiently, God's getting things done, setting the stage for things yet to come. The statement goes on. It says, the Bible reveals the true philosophy of history. In those words of matchless beauty and tenderness spoken by the Apostle Paul to the sages of Athens is set forth God's purpose in the creation and distribution of races and nations. I'm quoting Paul here. He hath made of one blood all nations of men, for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him and find him. Now the imagery there, that old English, feel after him, I was looking, and the New King James says, grope after him. You know, it's kind of like we're a little blind, and we're trying to find God, right? If perchance they might seek the Lord and find him. That's always God's purpose, is to assist people in finding him, okay? And that should be the purpose of our looking at history as well. A couple more statements here. I like this one. Above the distractions of earth, God sits enthroned. All things are open to his divine survey, and from his great and calm eternity, he orders that which his providence sees best. I have to ask, any of you remember a gentleman by the name of Elder Ralph Martin? Anybody ever hear? I got one hand. He started every sermon I think he ever gave in the last 30 years of his life. He started with this quote, and this one as well. Like the stars in the vast circuit of their appointed path, God's purposes know no haste and no delay. This fuse is moving on at the pace that God dictates, in the route and in the channel and in the means that he has chosen. And so our question is to try to understand that and decide how we're going to relate to it. It's going to happen. Where are we going to be when it does, and how's that going to work out? Okay, what are these purposes, right? God's purposes. No haste and delay. So what are they? Well, okay. Since we're looking at 1844, we're going to start off now with William Miller. William Miller is the kind of centerpiece character of the Millerite movement. And of course, back in that day, when anyone said Millerite, it was a derogatory term. Okay, we have taken it as a badge of honor. But back in the day, of course, it was derogatory. Miller was raised as a Christian. He was a farmer by trade. He was raised as a Christian, but in his teenage years, he became a deist. We don't really have deists around anymore, but they'd roughly be closest. They're not the same, but they'd be sort of like, functionally, sort of like an agnostic, kind of. Anyhow, deists believed in God, but they believed that he had created the world and then walked away. And so they did not see any place for actual divine involvement with the world. Well, of course, that meant no Jesus Christ is a savior, okay? No miracles, no revelation, no Bible. None of that counted. They believed in a rather amorphous God that had created things and then walked away. Well, Miller was deeply disturbed by a turn of events. He served as a captain in the U.S. Army in the War of 1812 and was at the decisive battle of Lake Plattsburgh, when everyone expected the British to win, but against all odds and generally perceived as being quite miraculously, the Americans won instead. I forget the exact figures. They were outnumbered something like 3-1 on the lake in terms of ships and firepower, and 4-1 on the land in terms of infantry or something like that. I forget the exact odds. No one expected the Americans to win, and yet they did. And the next day, the most common headline up and down the eastern coast of what's now the United States was, "What hath God wrought?" They acknowledged it as a miracle, which Miller was very thankful for, except he was deeply philosophically troubled because he didn't believe in miracles. Well, that led to some serious searching. Eventually, he realized, in quite a logical way, I'll just share this little piece here. It's interesting to me. Once he acknowledged that he had seen miracles, he said, logically, that, you know, by definition, a miracle is something above and beyond the understood natural realm or order of events. He said that indicates that there must, in fact, be a higher being. If there's a higher being, he said, then we have a multi-strata universe, okay? I'm here, somebody's up here. He wasn't a Christian at this point. He was still a deist, more or less. But he says, if there's a God and there's a God up here, then we have this stratification. You know, there's a higher, there's a lower. He said, logic and nature teach us that if you have a higher power and a lower power, there has to be a law to govern the relationship between the two. It doesn't work otherwise. He said, if there's a law, I greatly fear that I have broken it. He'd been a reasonably moral guy, you know. It's not like he'd been, you know, a mass murderer or anything. But his conscience told him that whatever that law was, he'd probably broken it. And he didn't know what that meant to him. And he debated this and he pondered this for a couple of years. Eventually, he concluded that really the only hope he had was that if this higher power happened to be benevolent, kind, only if the higher power would have mercy on him did he have a chance. So anyhow, eventually he becomes a Christian, let's put it that way. But in order to do that, he had to refute all the arguments that he'd brought against the Bible in his deist days. And so he started reading from Genesis, working his way through it, and he would only proceed as far as he could logically explain things. Eventually, he came down to this verse in Daniel. Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Well, Miller was certainly not the first person to run into this verse, nor the first person to spend a lot of time thinking about it. Sir Isaac Newton wrote a bunch about this verse, and lots of other scholars and theologians over the years had spent time looking at this verse. 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. It was commonly believed and understood that these days were prophetic days, meaning a year of literal time. That was not a new position to Miller. Lots of people had said that. But the big problem that everybody had was, when did it start? I illustrate this with a car. Suppose you have a car and it needs some transmission work. So you take it into the local tranny shop, and the nice guy says, "Oh yes, we work on those. We could have that fixed for you in 3 days." Very good. You leave the car, you come back 3 days later, and you say, "Is my car ready?" "No, your car's not ready." "Well, why is my car not ready? You told me you could fix it in 3 days." He said, "I can, but I haven't started on it yet." Okay? So, you know, it's nice to know the duration of a time period, but it doesn't do you a lot of good without knowing when it starts. Okay? That's the basic problem. Well, Miller did something that no one else had done. This is really the only specific theological contribution that William Miller made. He demonstrated a link between Daniel chapter 8, where this shows up, and Daniel chapter 9. Okay? So we'll go through that really quickly. These verses helped form one line of reasoning. The first verse is in Daniel 8. Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So Gabriel had been given a job, okay? But at the end of chapter 8, Daniel says, I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. Miller said, Gabriel's job is not done. He was told to make the man understand, and no one understood it. And then he goes looking further, and he sees in chapter 9, Gabriel returns and is speaking to Daniel, and he says, O Daniel, I have now come forth to give you skill to understand. Therefore, consider the matter and understand the vision. Well, there was no vision as such in Daniel 9, and so William Miller said he's talking about the vision of Daniel 8. So Daniel 9 is explanatory of Daniel 8. Well, that's an important thing to understand. And then he would point to this passage. 70 weeks are determined upon your for your people and for your holy city. Daniel 9:24. And he would draw attention to this word determined. The Hebrew for that word determined there is chatak or something. I really have never heard anyone pronounce this word, so I don't know how it's supposed to sound. I can think of about half a dozen different ways of pronouncing those letters, but I say chatak. Anyhow, and the literal meaning of that word is to cut off. So Miller thought about that, and he said, well, that's really kind of interesting. How does to cut off come to mean determined? And so he did a little bit of reading and a little Hebrew lexicography work or whatever it would be. And the simple illustration is, suppose I give you a 2x4 and I say, I need a piece that's 2 feet long. Well, you take that 2x4 and you put a little mark on it and you cut it off, the extra, and that cutting determines the length of it. That's the imagery involved in that word, okay? So Miller got to thinking about that for a little while, and he realized something really basic. If I tell you I want a 7.5-foot piece of 2x4, what do I have to give you so that you can provide me with my 7.5-foot piece of 2x4? An 8-foot stud. Okay. I can't give you 4 2-foot pieces, and, you know, it would be really complicated to, you know, glue them all back into shape or something. You have to have a longer one. And so Miller simply said, same thing with a time period. If you're going to cut 70 weeks off of something, it's going to have to be a time period that stretches longer than 70 weeks. Well, there's only one of those lying around handy. Chapter 8, the 2,300 days. So, once you've linked those two chapters, which, as I say, Miller's the first one to ever do that. It seems fairly simple in retrospect, looking back at it now and just reading those little details. But Miller was the first one to do that. Now, for what it's worth, there are about 2 or 3 additional arguments that Seventh-day Adventists have come up with in the time since. So we've got this one proved pretty solidly, actually, the linkage between Daniel 8 and 9. But Miller was basically working with these two, and that was enough in the mouth of 2 or 3 witnesses, right? So now you've got these two things linked. Now you're in a pretty good position to determine the beginning of the 2300 days, because we know the beginning of the 70 weeks. The 70 weeks in Daniel 9, it said it's the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem. That's when the 70-week prophecy starts, the 70-week period. And that wasn't a mystery. You can find the dating of that in any good encyclopedia or a history book or something like that. It was in the year 457 B.C. This is the decree that let the Jews go back and fully rebuild while they... There were 3 decrees. That's part of what confuses things a little bit. There were 3 different decrees, but this is the 3rd and final decree that establishes Jerusalem as the center of worship and the homeland of the Jews and the capital of the region. Okay. So knowing that it was 457 BC, Miller says, well, now we're in position to figure out how long the 2300 days is. Now we know when it's going to end. So you just have to do a little simple math, right? So how do you figure out from 457 BC how far 2,300 years would be? Well, Miller did a really simple thing. He took the 2,300 years and he said, well, there's 457 years BC, so we subtract those off the 2,300, and what's left would be the AD years. Piece of cake. It's really simple. Unfortunately, it's wrong, but it's very simple. The problem is, and if we were doing other things, I might ask you, but then I would run the risk of embarrassing someone, because when you ask a bunch of Adventists and say, what's wrong with that, almost always you're going to get somebody saying something about a zero year. There never was a zero year. There never will be a zero year. Nobody ever counted a zero year. Nobody ever failed to count a zero year. The only thing you could do is stick in a zero year, and that makes matters worse rather than making it better. So let's just not do that. So there's no zero year involved. It's crossing over the zero point, the barrier, the boundary between the BC and the AD time period. That's where it happens. And here's why it happens. Just think of it simply like this. The decree was promulgated in 457 BC. But it was near the end of October. And remember BC years, you're counting backwards type of thing? So the only portion of 457 BC that counted was the last week and a half or so of October and then November and December. So if we round that, it's not quite right. If we round that, it's there was only about a quarter of the 457 year that actually counted. So the equation should look like this. It wasn't 457 full years, it was 456 and about a quarter. And so if you do the math with that, the remainder at the bottom is 1843 all the way through 1843, and about three quarters of the way into 1844. Does that make sense? Everybody kind of following that one? Yeah. Okay. That's actually the correct answer as opposed to the 0 year thing. Now here's what's kind of funny about that. For historians, this is kind of a rookie mistake. Okay? Anytime you're measuring a time period that crosses that boundary of BC to AD, you have this same issue. You have to say, well, how much of the year did it include here, and how much of the year did it include there, you know? They're used to dealing with that. Miller should have been used to dealing with that. We might give him some, you know, benefit of the doubt. He wasn't a professional historian or anything of that nature, but he'd read a lot, and you'd think he would have caught on to it, but he missed it. But here's the funny thing. Everyone else missed it too, including Miller's most determined critic. There was a guy who just hated William Miller. Well, at least he hated Miller's teachings. I don't know if he hated Miller as a person or not. This guy was really a pain. You know, he would travel. I mean, he wasn't getting paid to do it, but he would travel around and go where Miller was speaking. So he'd set up shop in some building a half mile away, and he'd preach an anti-Miller sermon, you know, type of thing. Okay. He was considered a Bible scholar. He'd graduated from Princeton, so that should have been worth something. You can find a nice article on the guy in Wikipedia if you want. Tell you all about him. It doesn't really mention his antagonism to Miller, though. I was surprised at that, because that was one of the things that, you know, was his claim to fame. The intriguing part is that this particular gentleman's name, his name was George Bush. The Wikipedia article says that he is only distantly related to the Bush political family. So, yeah, I don't know if that's any important whatsoever. But the point is, as Ellen White put it, the Lord held his hand over this mistake, and he used it for his own purposes along the way. But we're not going to spend a lot of time on that right now. So, back to this verse. You probably already know this, most of you, but I want to make sure everybody's tracking here. So the next thing to understand is that when this verse speaks of the sanctuary, it was commonly understood at the time that that was a code name? I don't know. Somehow or the other, they thought that meant the earth. That's just one of those urban legend things. Somehow somebody says, maybe it means the earth. And the next guy says, well, Marvin thinks it means the earth. And the next guy says, well, I've heard that there are people that believe it means the earth. And the next guy says, it's a widely agreed upon consensus that it means the earth. And something like that, I don't know how it actually works, but the Bible never uses the word sanctuary to mean the earth. So, whatever. Anyhow, Miller was, after all, human. And on this particular point, he got himself into trouble, okay? Because this is one of the few things that he did not ever think to go checking biblically. What he did is he accepted the common opinion and said, well, okay, that must be what it is. And so when he ran his math and he came up with 1843, it was only about 25 more years. And he's thinking that this cleansing of the sanctuary was actually the cleansing of the earth by fire. And that was to happen at the second coming, is in his understanding of things. And so he came to the conclusion, we would say mistaken in some regards, but he came to the conclusion that the 2300 days would end in 1843, and then, of course, subsequently revised up to 1844. And that much he was correct. The idea that represented the second coming, in that part he was incorrect. It was a lot like the disciples, actually, who held to some misconceptions because that's what they'd been taught all their lives. The biggest one, of course, was that Jesus was going to sit on the throne of David in Jerusalem and rule the world and bring the Gentiles into subjection and life would be wonderful. Well, that's not exactly what happened, of course. And they were seriously disappointed. The same thing happened to Miller and the Millerites, that their expectation did not turn out to be correct in every detail, and they too were seriously disappointed. That's not going to be our focus, however. We want to look at the good work done before the disappointment. So let's jump on ahead here. Miller kind of sat on his conclusion. Like I say, it was about 1817 when he first said, wow, 1843, the Lord's going to return. That was a big story, the newspaper people would say. But Miller was not a preacher. He was a farmer. And so he kind of sat on the story. Time passed, and it kept kind of bugging him in the back of his mind. Maybe I had to do something about this, but he didn't know what to do. Finally, in 1831, we have this little episode. My distress became so great, I entered into a solemn covenant with God that if he would open the way, I would go and perform my duty to the world. What do you mean by opening the way? Seemed to come to me. Why, said I, if I should have an invitation to speak publicly in any place, I will go and tell them what I find in the Bible about the Lord's coming. Instantly, all my burden was gone, and I rejoiced that I would not probably be thus called upon, for I had never had such an invitation. My trials were not known, and I had but little expectation of being invited to any field of labor. Well, that was a nice try. Within half an hour, there came a knock at Miller's door, and Irving Guilford, Irving's 16-year-old nephew, delivered his message. Our minister is away, and the folks want you to come and talk to the people on the second advent of Christ. We'll have the neighbors come to our house, and you can have the whole church there. Miller hadn't been counting on this. So without saying a word, he turned and stalked out the back door. Irving was kind of left on ice. In a small grove of trees behind the house, Miller fell to his knees, and in the somber silence, his conscience thundered, "Will you make a covenant with God and break it so soon?" He had promised that if he got an invitation to speak, he would. God had taken him up on the deal, and in less than half an hour, he had his invitation. It's a pretty simple issue. What else could he say but, "Lord, I will go." And so he eventually realized he had to. The Lord put him in a position where he had to either carry through or just blatantly break his word. He was unwilling to do the latter and was far from enthusiastic on the former. But he was constrained, as the saying goes. And so go he did. And he went off and he preached that Sunday on his sister and brother-in-law's front porch. He didn't want to presume to take the pulpit in the church. He was not a preacher. But he sat in a rocking chair and he preached on the front porch, and the neighbors all stood and sat around and they stroked their chins gravely and said, "That's a really interesting thought." This is 1831, so 1843 now is only 12 years away. Well, I think he stayed an extra day, if I remember the story right. Visited with his relatives and all that sort of thing, and then he made his way home. When he was almost home, he stopped at the post office and picked up his mail, and in the mail there was an invitation to come and speak at another church. It wasn't a deluge at the beginning, but word eventually started getting out that Miller has some interesting things to say, and the invitations kept coming in, and he was often on the road and speaking. Miller spent months away from home, traveling by train, boat, or stage, which wasn't so simple back in those days. You know, it's easy. I mean, you know, yesterday I was sitting on an airplane. Well, that's not the same as a stagecoach. You know, you always have turbulence on a stagecoach. And less padding on the seat, too, I imagine. After an illness of several months' duration in 1843, he toured New England and New York, preaching 85 times in 60 days, besides attending to all his other duties. Back home from one such trip, he wrote, "Those souls whom I have addressed in my 6 months' tour are continually before me, sleeping or waking. I can see them perishing by the thousands." Miller was dealing with a very vivid perception. The Lord's coming in just a few years, in just a few less years now. And now it's down to months. The Lord's coming in just a few months. What's going to happen to all these people? In January 1844, after the year 43 had ended, Miller had not by that time realized his error, hadn't made that shift, but he was still thinking in terms of the Jewish year, and that changes in the spring. And so even though it was now 1844 on our calendar, he was still counting it as the year 1843, but time was running out, type of thing, and he was coming down to the end of his expectations. In January 1844, he said this. He said, "I have preached about 4,500 lectures in about 12 years to at least 500,000 people." He'd been a busy guy. "I have broken my constitution and lost my health." And for what? "If possible, I might be the means of saving some." When you accept a commission, I guess, as a minister of the Lord, there are serious issues at stake. And I'm glad he carried them seriously in his heart. Well, we're going to jump to another fellow right now, Joshua Hines. Miller worked by himself for about 8 years, from 31 to 39. Finally, in December of 39, he was invited by this gentleman on the screen here, Joshua V. Hines. I didn't put the V in, but anyhow. Joshua Hines was the pastor of the Chardon Street Chapel in Boston. Chardon Street was kind of an upper crust sort of a church. Okay, it was a little stylish. You know, that's where all the nice people went. Okay, Hines kind of was pushing the boundaries, having this old farmer come in. But Chardon Street had been a socially active church. They had been abolitionist. Still were in the 1840s, of course, because there was still slavery down south. So they were against it. They had been, temperance-oriented. They were opposed to alcoholic drinks and such things. They had taken up these different causes, and so Hines thought, here's another cause coming along. Let's see what we think about this one. Well, Hines listened to Miller's whole series of lectures. Didn't say much. Just listened and thought and wondered and pondered and considered and wasn't sure what this meant to him. Finally, after the last lecture and all the people were gone, it was just Hines and Miller. And Hines walked up to Miller and asked him two questions. "Do you really believe this? Level with me, man. Come on. Are you just a con guy? Con artist? Do you really believe this stuff?" Miller assured him that he did. Hines kind of thought he believed it too. What was he going to do now? This is 1839. 1843 is just, well, it's December of 39, so it's almost 1840. It's not very long. He says, "Well, if you believe it, what are you doing to spread it to the world? I mean, if the Lord's going to come, it's going to affect the whole world. What are you doing about it, man?" Miller replied, "What can an old farmer do? I was never used to public speaking. I stand quite alone. And though I have labored much and seen many converted to God and the truth, yet no one as yet seems to enter into the object and spirit of my mission so as to render me much aid. They like to have me preach and build up their churches. And there it ends with most of the ministers as yet. I've been looking for help. I want help. Got to give the man credit. He's just an old farmer doing what he could do. Now Himes was the one under pressure. What's he going to do? He thought briefly of his career, his family, his friends, his place in society. And he made one of the more consequential decisions of his life. I laid myself, family, society, reputation, all upon the altar of God to help him to the extent of my power to the end. I then told him that he might prepare for the campaign, for doors should be opened in every city in the Union, and the warning should go to the ends of the earth. Here I began to help Father Miller. Himes had the societal connections. He had the know-how. You know, different people have different talents. Miller was an old farmer, but Himes was pretty sharp at maneuvering through the power structure of Boston and the East Coast. Within a few weeks, Himes had the first issue of the Signs of the Times rolling off the presses. This was the first of a host of Millerite publications he masterminded. He also published the Second Advent Library, the colorful prophetic chart, and an innumerable number of books, pamphlets, and tracts. In addition, he arranged for Miller's repeated return to Boston, as well as New York, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. He spoke before Congress. In effect, Himes became general manager, chief organizer, promoter, and publicist of Adventism. The Millerite movement had now entered its publicly prominent phase for just the last 4 years. But it came at a price. Himes had a choice he had to make. And he made it. I'm going to jump to another one now. Joseph Bates. Bates had been a sea captain. That name up there is obviously wrong. That should say Joseph Bates, but anyhow. Bates had been a sea captain, and he'd lived a pretty adventurous life, actually, all around the ocean and such things. He was older and retired when he first heard Miller's teachings. He went to his first Millerite meeting. And he listened, and he thought. He thought some more. And on his way home that night, he and his wife were in a buggy or carriage or some such thing. And on the way home, he suddenly turned to his wife and he said, "That's the truth. That's the truth. So what's he going to do about it?" Well, one of his stories here. He was in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. Is where he lived. He says, "I was told that if I went south," now we don't think of it so much anymore, but Maryland was south in those days. Right? Okay. Remember, Maryland ended up being a Confederate state, not in the Union. Okay. Bam. "I was told that if I went south, the slaveholders would kill me for being an abolitionist," which he was. "I saw there was some danger, but imperative duty and a desire to benefit them and unburden my soul overbalanced all such obstacles. So, okay, let's just put our life on the line." He went down to Annapolis, then across the Chesapeake Bay to Kent Island for whatever reasons. Why he went there, I don't know. They began holding meetings. He had a friend with him, the two of them. And they were giving these lectures. And some of the folks, the good population of the place, got a little stirred up. Near the close of his series of lectures, someone in the audience stood up and told him and his fellow lecturer that there was a company about 2 miles off at a rum store preparing to attack them. Then up rose a man to denounce what Bates had been preaching. His denunciation soon became so violent that he began to talk about riding us on a rail. How many of you know what it means to be ridden out of town on a rail? it's not such a popular thing any longer. Is that, really? There's not so many hands. Okay, so I'm obviously going to have to explain this. Now, everybody know what a rail is? Well, no. And not the rail of a railroad tracks. The rail of a split rail fence. Okay, you know what a split rail fence is? Take your logs and you split them into fours, and so you got this kind of a pie shape, pizza pie shape type of a thing, rail, and you use those to make your, you know, the horizontals on your fence. That was a rail. So riding a person out of town on a rail amounted to sticking one of these things between their legs and tying their ankles tight on the other side, and then you hoist it up on the shoulders of a couple of guys and you carry them out of town. If they happen to remain upright, it's painful. And if they flip over upside down, it's worse. So it was a way of kind of, you know, getting across the idea that we don't really want you here. Okay? Well, so they talk about riding him out of town on a rail. Bates replied, "We are all ready for that, sir. If you will put a saddle on it, we would rather ride than walk. You must not think that we have come 600 miles through the ice and snow at our own expense to give you the midnight cry without first sitting down and counting the cost. And now, if the Lord has no more for us to do, we might as well lie at the bottom of the Chesapeake Bay as anywhere else until the Lord comes. But if he has any more work for us to do, you can't touch us." Apparently the story got around, and pretty soon the local newspaper editor wrote it up. He commented, "The wreck of matter and the crush of worlds is but a small consideration to one who can take things so coolly as this." Okay, well, that's a little grandiose perhaps, but the idea is there. One more story, or more than one story, one more person here. James White. Perhaps you recognize this guy. In 1842, James was 20 years old, and he was under heavy conviction to go preach the Second Advent. Conviction is one thing, but that's not what he wanted to do. He wanted to go to school and become a scholar and end up being a reputable person of the community. But the community might not last for more than about a year. So what's he going to do? Well, the conviction finally won out. He made an appointment to preach. He had no particular professional training in this regard, and his first few sermons were not particularly successful. He was timid, and he lacked confidence. Once, somebody said, "Why don't you preach here? There will be two young ministers there, and they can kind of maybe help you out, give you some pointers." That one didn't go well at all. And 20 minutes into his sermon, he just got himself all mixed up, messed up, and embarrassed. And his thinking kind of got twisted in knots, and so he just shut up and sat down. The whole preaching thing wasn't turned out to be a real good thing for him so far. But he was still under conviction. What do you do? What do you do? And so he spent a fair amount of time praying about this. He wasn't getting off the hook, but it wasn't working. What was the problem? Finally, he concluded that he was reaping the results of his own divided heart. He still was hanging on to this, "I want to be a scholar" thing. Maybe if I preach a little bit, then I can go ahead and be a scholar on the side. Or maybe I can just preach on the side and be a scholar. And that wasn't what the Lord was asking him to do. Eventually it got to the point where James decided he needed to get in or get out. There's really no sense at all in trying to be halfway into the Lord's side of things. What are you going to do? You're going to trick him into thinking that you're, you know, really something you're not? That seems like a very low percentage success rate to trick the Lord on such matters. So he spent a lot of time studying. He did become a scholar, but he became a scholar of what he needed to be preaching. And he decided to get in all the way. He wrote, "I had neither horse, saddle, bridle, nor money, yet felt that," there should be an "I," I believe, right there, "that I must go. I had used my past winter's earnings, buying necessary clothing, in attending Second Advent meetings, and the purchase of books and the chart. But my father offered me the use of a horse for the winter. An elder Pauly gave me a saddle with both pads torn off and several pieces of an old bridle." Operative word there is pieces. "I gladly accepted these and cheerfully placed the saddle on a beech log and nailed on the pads, fastened the pieces of the bridle together with malleable nails, folded my chart with a few pamphlets on the subject of the Advent over my breast, snugly buttoned up in my coat, and left my father's house on horseback." Well, at first he only gave 3 lectures. But, you know, he's getting better. And every place he went, he added a lecture. Until he had 6. Okay, it's good. At the close of a week's series of lectures in the town of Burnham, 60 people arose for prayers. That was the standard approach in those days, calling for making an altar call. You know, do you want to seek the Lord? Come forward for prayers. James didn't have a clue what to do. Never been in that position before. He was unprepared for that. He'd used up all his information. Indeed, by this time, he'd stretched it to a point and given 7 lectures. And so, not knowing how to handle this, he sent for his brother. He'd been in the ministry for a number of years. And his brother, John, raised up a large church on the interest thus begun. That's one way for a young guy to learn how to be a preacher. Get yourself into an awkward position and watch somebody bail you out, maybe take notes. Well, in April of 1843, now just remember the timing on this. Miller at this point is still saying the Lord's coming in 1843. And now it's April 1843. James was still continuing his winter labors. Incidentally, in that winter tour, more than 600 people were converted or baptized, depending on which church they belonged to. You know, not every church was into baptism in those days. And the Millerite movement was really an interdenominational type of a thing. It went to almost all the churches to some degree. But here it is in April, and he's continuing his journey. He says, "Rain came on, and the firmly trodden drifts," that would be snow drifts, "became soft, so that my horse, with my weight upon him, would frequently sink to his body in the snow. I rode all day with my feet out of the stirrups, and as he would plunge into the snow, I would instantly slide off and relieve him of my weight, that he might better struggle out, or if he could not do this alone, I could assist him by lifting where most needed." It's not an easy way to make a living. And I don't know that he was actually earning any money in the process either. But he felt called to do it, so he did. One time James was in his travels, he came back to a small town where he had preached before. There was a minister there who did not appreciate James's preaching. And so he saw him on the street, and he loudly called to him. He said, "Mr. White, are you still in the land of the living?" James fired back, "No, sir, I'm in the land of the dying. But at the coming of the Lord, I expect to go to the land of the living." When it all came down to brass tacks, for James White, the stakes were just too high to sit back and do nothing. So he said this, second quote, there it is, "God forbid that I should fold my arms in lazy lock while sinners are sinking to eternal light." Took me a while. I had to do a little hunting. Do you know what lazy lock is? It's lazy lock. Well, another individual. Of course, these pictures are all later in the lives of these individuals. I Hope you've figured that out. We don't have a lot of pictures from the 1840s. This is Ellen Harmon, later Ellen White, of course. She was just a teenager during the Millerite movement. But she makes some interesting comments looking back in later years. This one's intriguing. She says, of all the great religious movements since the days of the apostles, none have been more free from the from human imperfections and the wiles of Satan than was that of the autumn of 1844. That's pretty high recommendation, actually. But why? What made this great religious movement so much greater than the others, right? Well, this is only our first meeting, so I don't have to answer all the questions right now. We'll be looking at that along the way. What was the qualifying attribute of the Midnight Cry movement in the autumn of 1844? What made it less plagued by human imperfection, and what made it more free from the wiles of Satan? But this goes back to my suggestion earlier that there's a single purpose the Lord is working on. That through all this, there is a single theme that is being developed that he is pushing on towards. In the fall of 1844, the followers of Christ more nearly attained to God's ideal than in, what, the Reformation, say? Now, looking at great religious movements since the days of the apostles. More nearly attained to that ideal than the Wesleyan revivals? But how? What did they do? What was the key issue? At the beginning of this meeting, we read that God made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him. That's the New King James. Of course, Ellen White's quote was from the original King James. If you consider the stories we've gone over tonight, you'll see that every individual came to a point where they had to make a decision. They had to decide whether they were going to put away their own interests, their own apparent well-being, and simply go forward trusting in God to take care of them. This was true, not only of the more well-known leaders that we've looked at here, but a lot of the followers. Surely you've heard the story about the people who didn't harvest their potatoes in the fall of 1844. The Lord blessed them, and they came out okay on that particular episode. But there were lots of others as well. There were people who sold everything they had. They were going to go to heaven. They didn't need this anymore. What's interesting is that there was, after the disappointment in October of 1844, there was immediate concern that a lot of the Millerites would be destitute now because they'd sold their stuff. In some cases, they'd sold their homes, they sold their farms. Amazingly enough, it didn't turn out that bad. There weren't very many cases of people really coming out dreadfully badly. Let's put it that way. The Millerites as a whole pulled together and they cared for their own. And that was good. In a nutshell, I'm suggesting that it is that simple matter of trusting God for all that one needs that is at the heart of the great controversy, all the way through. And consequently, it's at the very heart of so many of our Adventist history stories. This idea of trusting God to take care of you, this idea of just having confidence in God, is in fact the central issue in the whole war between Christ and Satan. It is the slowly burning fuse that dictates the shape and the direction of emerging providence and world events. Tomorrow morning, we're going to jump down to 1888, when, of course, the matter of faith came to prominence again in a different setting, in a different context. And once again, the devil sought to confuse things, because that's what he always does. When the Lord's work moves forward, the devil is doing all he can to interrupt and interfere with it. That's the common thread that we're going to find linking these different events. I really wish we could cover all the factual details, all the stories of all the different individuals. Some of them are really fascinating, but we can't. But I'd encourage you to do a little reading on the side sometime. You know, grab a good book on the Millerite movement or something. There are several available. I think there's probably a few in the library over here. So I would encourage you to do that. Pastor, do you want to close with prayer? Shall I close with prayer? Okay. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father, we look back at these stories, we look back at these individuals, and we see their decisions. We remember them as kind of the heroes of our faith. And yet we do so at an arm's distance. We do so without always feeling the same urgency and the same necessity. We aren't in exactly their circumstances, and it's not so clear. We don't have a clock ticking down to 1843. We do look at the world events around us, and we shake our heads sometimes, and we wonder, we ponder. But Lord, we ask that you would help us to know what we are to do. What is our calling in the day in which we live? We pray that you would lead us and assist us. Help us to gain that level of confidence in you that no matter what may be asked of us, no matter what circumstances you may place us in, that our faith in you would remain strong. We pray that you will guide us, direct us, bless us through the Sabbath day, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave.